Welcome to the New Mind Creator Podcast with your host, Maurice, the New Mind Creator. Today I will be interviewing Clint Adams. Please make sure to hit the subscribe button so that you'll receive alerts when new episodes are available on Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. So, Clint, how long were you a police officer?
I worked for the police for nearly 10 years, but I was a police officer for about six years of those and 4 years of doing other things, including counseling and that kind of stuff.
And you are in Australia, correct?
That's correct. I live in Queensland, which is a northern state now, but I was in the police force down in Victoria, which is one of the southern states of Australia.
So do you know about policing, or have you heard anything about policing in the United States versus Australia?
Yeah, I mean, over the years when I was doing the other stuff for the police, I did a fair bit of research because we were developing programs and things like that. So I have had a bit of exposure to what, you know, things are out there for the US kind of police. I guess the city's a bit different. So the structure's a bit different to here. We're state-based and each state run their own kind of police force. So we've literally got one for each state and that's it. Whereas obviously the US are a little bit different and they're kind of more city-run stuff. So yeah, but in terms of, you know, a lot of approaches and things, we certainly borrow a lot of, there's obviously a lot more Americans out there and there's a lot more different ideas and thinking around that. So yeah, I've had quite a bit of exposure over the years to a fair bit of the U.S. police stuff.
And what's the purpose of the police department in Australia? What would you say the purpose is?
Look, the same, I think, everywhere. It's about trying to keep law and order. And, you know, we call it the thin blue line here where it's about, you know, I guess seeing the police as being there to help keep order and enforce the laws of the land and make sure that, you know, people are, I guess, sticking to the laws. And ultimately, it's about trying to do proactive things as well as reactive things. I guess a lot of the police work is reactive. We go into crimes and investigating things and trying to put the bad guy or bad person behind bars type of thing to keep them off the streets and keep people safe. But then there's also a lot of, you know, more positive initiatives these days about trying to, you know, minimize criminality, working with other agencies and you know, helping people who are at risk of, you know, doing things because of their socioeconomic background and things like that. So there's a lot of, I guess, proactive and reactive things that the police certainly do here in Australia. And I dare say it wouldn't be dissimilar to what you guys are doing over there.
Okay. So I believe there's always a reason for that we do something or we get into a certain area, a certain thing in our lives that we are passionate about. So I know that you are, you know, really passionate about suicide prevention and working in that realm. What was it that got you into that state of mind to, you know, help in that way?
Yeah, it was probably a convoluted ending. I'm nearly 50 this year, and you know, over the years things certainly changed. It probably wasn't as big a passion of mine when I first started out. I started out being very interested in psychology when I was at high school, and back in those days, Silence of the Lambs and profiling was fairly new to the world. You know, I was reading books on that stuff. John Douglas's Mindhunter and stuff like that were very big interests of me. So I was always interested in psychology and I guess human beings and how we think. But over time, as I got more exposure to, you know, seeing young kids in homes, obviously as a police officer, you get called to people's houses, not for good things. And, you know, often you're seeing young kids and you're thinking, wow, look at the parents. They're not great role models. They're druggies. They're whatever. And, so you kind of wonder how these kids are going to, you know, get out of that, being in that environment. Obviously, sometimes they take them out of the homes and then they go to foster homes and they go from home to home to home. And so a lot of those kinds of things over the years also added up to me eventually going down this path. But I also I also had an experience when I was looking after a woman in our cells in one of the police stations I worked in where She was by herself waiting court, and she was in there for a few days. And I happened to be the person who was in charge of cells at the time. And long story short, I had some conversations with her. She was facing a stretch in the slammer, so to speak. And you know, a lot of the conversations I was having with her is around how she could change her focus, how she could turn her life around. And so, you know, we had some pretty good conversations through the door. And look, at the time, I probably didn't realize that it had such a big effect on me. But probably a year later, I actually ended up going into prison. About a year later, I was doing a run, and a person kind of flagged me down from one of the houses, and I realized it was her. She'd got out of prison. She looked a lot healthier, and she said, "Look, I saw you running past, and I a couple of times, and I thought if you come past again, I'll kind of call out to you." And she told me, you know, that the experience that we had in the cells and the conversations I had with her had an effect on how you know, what she focused on, what she wanted to do when she got out. She had a young baby that had been taken off her and was living with her parents and all that kind of stuff. And so it was at that point a really emotional moment for me. I had a realization that, you know, it had an effect on this woman just through trying to get her to change her focus and do things differently. And then I kind of changed my police path after that. And really, I did some more studies, more in rehabilitation counseling. So I became a true counselor. I went and worked for another company, doing counseling with people one-on-one, like you'd expect to do, helping people with problems. And so that's kind of where a big part of the interest came into it. And yeah, from there, I just kind of went into other roles, went back to the police and worked for them as a counselor, worked for them doing program development. And then over time, I got into more people and culture or HR, like human resources type stuff that most companies would be used to. But I really focused quite heavily on health and well-being. I know it's probably a bit more popular now, but back in you know, the early 2000s, it wasn't quite as big as it is now. And so I was probably one of those people that really focused on how can we help our employees to be more resilient, to focus on their mental health, to focus and look after each other. You know, we work with people all the time, and so part of that was a bit of a growing process. And then there was another kind of not incident, but I worked for a company which was a healthcare provider, and I was part of the executive team at the time, and I had access to a lot of information about the services we provided. And I was kind of horrified to see that, you know, we had young 11 and 12 year olds on antidepressants and being on suicide watch through our community centers and services. And you know, all these things really bugged me, and it got me back to thinking about, well, how can I impact on younger people? Because obviously they come into the workforce as older people, but they've all been kids just like I've been a kid. And you know, ultimately some of these patterns of thinking, and some of them aren't very positive, can have a massive effect on you. So I really got interested in how can I impact at a school level when, you know, kids are, I guess, not as influenced as much as when they're older. Obviously, as you get older, you know, all these things over time can accumulate. And if you're younger, you could probably not bounce back better, but you could get taught things a lot easier and a lot quicker. And you're not kind of having to use a change management model. You're trying to influence them in good ways and provide them with some good structure at a school level. And so that's kind of where a lot of, I guess, my passion for this has come over the last few years, especially writing the book. The book was definitely about using the school program to kind of write a story around a person who is on the verge of suicide, and how we can kind of help people deal with that, how we can help schools deal with the aftermath, but then also how they can change things so that other kids don't get in the same predicament. So that's kind of the short and sweet version of how I've come to be doing what I'm doing.
So did you know at the time you were, helping, trying to help the lady, did you know you were going to have such a positive impact on her? Because it seems like you really left a mark on her that she, saw you and it meant a lot to her to, engage you to let you know how she was doing.
Yeah, look, I think as I look back at the time, I kind of knew a bit about psychology anyway, and they do teach you some of the basics when you're doing your initial degree on counseling. And obviously you're trying to dabble in a broad amount of things in the psychology course. And so in my background, I kind of always, always found I was kind of influential, even as a police officer, being able to calm people down. And looking back now, I've done a lot more research since my police days, and now I can see why some of my methods and other cops out there obviously use some of these techniques too. And sometimes we don't know why it's effective, but I as I've done more and more study into the brain and the subconscious and the unconscious and our fight and flight stuff like that, I realized that, I was probably, on an intuitive level, maybe better equipped than some other people. I kind of can stay calm. I was able to calm people down. And so I used part of that when I was talking to her around, well, how, in my head, I'm thinking this woman's by herself. She's clearly in a bad state. She's thinking about all the stupid things she's done and what's brought her to the point where she's going inside. And so it was about really trying to just see what I could do to help her, just change her focus a bit. At the time, I was probably, I didn't realize it probably had this much of an effect on her to the point that she kind of, felt okay to come and look me up kind of thing. And so now at the time, I mean, you try to do those things. And I think any, like a mental first aider would do something similar. We're trying to, if people's in a bad state, we're here to help. We're trying to talk them through things and see hopefully that, it can work. And obviously in this case for her, it did leave a mark for her and made her ask some questions. And, it was probably the right time for her to be talking to me. And yeah, I mean, ultimately that's what we aim at, but you don't always get those results, I guess.
So I know that I guess there are sometimes that people tend to give up earlier than other people when faced with strenuous circumstances or, life struggles. But what are
Yes.
some things that a person can do to increase their resiliency?
Yeah, look, one of the key things for me, and this is probably going to be answer to the question you're going to ask me a bit later on, but a key for me when I'm really focusing on is allowing people to ask themselves, what do they want to change in their life? Like when people are going through stuff, and to your point, if they kind of give up or that kind of stuff, they kind of have to recognize that they don't want to be there. People know when they're in trouble. People know instinctively that this is not a good feeling. The problem is they don't always know how they can change that because all they're consumed by is how they're feeling in that moment and whatever's happening in their lives. That's where their focus goes. And so, a big key for me is about people asking questions. It does a couple of things. Is asking questions about themselves around, am I happy with where I am? If the answer is clearly no, then, you need to do something about that. And focusing on some positive aspects of that is such a key, and there's many ways to the top of this mountain. As I mentioned before, when you do your psych degree, we touch on lots of different theories of psychology and all this stuff, and they all work for a reason. And the reason is they change the focus for the person. Whenever I read anything about people that have come out of some trauma or things like that, it's always, this thing was happening to me. It wasn't good, but then I made a decision that I had to do something else. I either, some people find religion, some people go on a crazy fitness regime, and things that change the focus and get you through is sometimes very individualized, and it's about asking those questions from yourself, looking at options. As long as you're looking at options, you're more problem-solving focused, and that's using a different part of the brain. When people get stuck in some of the stuff that you're mentioning now, it's usually amygdala driven. It's what I call red brain responses, which is part of that fight or flight. It's anger, it's sadness, it's fear. And so it's about understanding how you can use your brain, and your conscious brain I'm talking about here, where you kind of have to think your way through to a solution. When you become problem-solving focused, you're using what I call blue brain, which is the frontal cortex, the prefrontal cortex, and that's a big part of the brain. It requires things to change for you. You need to pump blood back up to your oxygenate to oxygenate your brain and all this stuff. So there's a number of physical parts that go with that, and there's a number of very real thinking parts and wiring and firing of neurons and all that kind of stuff that come into play about making things change in your head. When I was dealing with people with PTSD, for example, who've had, say, a bad experience, you know, a gun pointed at their head or whatever, and it turns them to mush in terms of how they've reacted to that. A big part is getting them to understand that, you know, once you've had an experience and now there's a memory of that experience and you're thinking about it, that past only exists in your head. It's not real anymore. And so understanding that you have control of how that memory has an impact on you, how you can change what that memory looks like. Because we do actually, we don't even realize, but you know, over time our memories of events and specific details of things actually deteriorate. And sometimes we start to create things that never actually happened in there. And you know, we start to overthink what could have happened. If I had a gun point at my head, I could have died, I could have this, I could have that. And yes, they're all things that could have happened, but they didn't happen. But you're telling your brain that it has. And so understanding some of that components of taking charge, taking real control of where that unconscious thoughts go is such a key part of understanding how you can change things for the better or create better habits of thinking.
So you mentioned a little bit about PTSD just a moment ago. What are
Yes.
some ways a person who has PTSD can change their mindset instead of just constantly allowing their mind to just run rampant and over again thinking of that trauma just constantly?
Yes. Yeah, so one of the techniques when I first work with someone that's had that kind of experience is getting them to understand that the fact that they're thinking about the same thing in the same way and having the same reaction means that the neurons in their brain are wiring and firing together, and that's creating a habit. So that's the first part they need to actually understand. And then I'm talking to them about some techniques that changes which neurons are wiring and firing together. So if you think about the same thing and you go down the same path, the same ones will wire and fire over and over and over, and you create that pattern. So what I'm trying to do here is trying to interrupt those neurons wiring and firing together. So little things like, so when someone thinks in that space, what's happening is the amygdala, as I mentioned before, gets triggered, and that allows, you know, people fear or anger or whatever comes with it. And so there's a process that goes with that. The adrenal gland kicks in. Blood starts to drain from your brain and is going into your muscles, so you're getting ready for fight or flight. That's the natural response. So if they're thinking in that way, they have that same kind of cascade of things happening in their bodies. So what we're trying to do is interrupt that. So one of the things I get them to do is quite simple initially, is just to do a thoughts diary. And there's a couple of good reasons for that. One is they have to at least do analysis work. As basic as it is for analysis work, so just catch yourself, when does that thing pop in your head? I want you to write down, you know, what you thought, and at the time, that's all you need to do for the first time. So part of that is to try and change that gears, that I want blood pumping back up to use, as I said before, using the blue brain or the prefrontal cortex to start thinking about things. So doing analysis work is thinking about things. And again, you want to interrupt that wiring and firing of the neurons that were firing when you were thinking about that old event. And two, you want to try and use the best part of your brain to try and think of a solution. So just by doing a thoughts diary in the first few days breaks the pattern a little bit. So instead of thinking about the event, going down and feeling sad or feeling angry or whatever comes with that particular experience for the person, it's about saying, okay, it popped in my head. Instead of going all the way down to where I normally go, oh, I'm acknowledging that it's a thought. I'm writing it down. I've actually interrupted that process. So the more times they do that, or the further they get away from the initial reaction, the more likely you are to change things. I then even do silly things like saying, you know, when that thought pops in your head, I want you to do a couple of things. I don't know if you've heard of centering, but centering is just basically taking note of it, doing something physical. So you stand up, you imagine someone's pulling you from the top up. So you know, getting good at your posture. Again, it's changing techniques and it's interrupting that wiring and firing of that initial thought, but you're replacing it now with something physical. You're thinking about something else. You know, even little things like wiggling your toes. I know it sounds silly, but sometimes a bit of laughter and, oh, I'll wiggle my toes. So I have to really focus on that. I actually got to use a part of the brain that's not engaged in that initial thought of, you know, the trauma that I've experienced. So these techniques, you know, and there's many ways to the top of that mountain. As I said before, you know, anything that can change your focus, get you thinking, The other thing I do later on is, work with the person and say, okay, let's play with that event now in your head to try and show them how much control they have of that event. That event is gone. It's not existing. It's only existing in their heads now. And so understanding, like as a I call it being the director. So I say, okay, think of it as a movie. Let's play it out in the movie. You're the director. And now I want you to change some things as it goes through it. It'd be, the person had a gun. Okay, let's turn him into a clown now. Let's, make the gun shoot out a bang sign or anything that kind of shows control of that. And it's important that they can understand that they do have control and that, when it's unconscious, it'll take you where it wants you to go. But if you're consciously thinking about it, you can actually direct where it goes. And talking to the unconscious is another important thing around having internal dialogue around influencing it. Instead of it just taking you taking it to where you want it to go, and it'll respond. And that's part of, a number of techniques I use through a PTSD kind of
So
process.
you, the more the person engages in these exercises and techniques that you implement, they are going further away from that, rewiring their brain, so to speak, and going away from that traumatic event.
Look, the event's never going to go away. We will always have the memory of that event, but we can interrupt how far and how deep we get influenced, right? Like if someone dies in our life, obviously it's traumatic and we're sad that that person's no longer in our life. And there's no issue with grieving and stuff like that. But ultimately, it becomes a problem when it's 10 years on and you haven't moved on. I dealt with a couple of parents and they both were police officers whose young child had died, and they really struggled with the grieving process. They wouldn't change his bedroom, they wouldn't do anything different. They, and so a big part of working with them was exactly where we're trying to interrupt how they felt about it. Nothing's going to change what happened at all. Nothing's going to change how sad they're going to feel and the loss that they've had. But ultimately, it's about how they can focus on, well, what can I still do? How can I still function? How can I, what would my son think of me as a parent in this state? And me just sitting there moping around and doing nothing and just constantly crying and that kind of stuff isn't helping them move on, helping, and so them having to focus on those kinds of things was really important in their grieving process. Them acknowledging that their son, had a short life, but they could celebrate some of those things were, excuse me, a big part of trying to change things. And it can be tough, obviously. It's not going to happen overnight, but yes, the techniques are there to help people deal with the memories of things that have been bad, but ultimately about how they go, okay, it's popped in my head. And if they get better at having a habit that actually takes them to a better place, or it's not about denying it. This is where the difference between, just getting out and drinking yourself unconscious until the next day, that's not going to help you. You're not dealing with the issue. You're not changing a habit. You're just masking it. So, those techniques are all aimed at trying to change those thought patterns and replace them with better thought patterns and better activities that can kind of lead to a better, I guess, better processes for
Cool.
them.
So, no, that sounds like really helpful information. And I'm sure you've been helping a lot of people with the various techniques. Yeah, it
Hope so.
sounds like you have been. And, with trauma, it imprints, but you're helping people to deal with it. And while you're doing that, it's even strengthening the person, it sounds like, because it's showing them that they have control over their thoughts instead of their thoughts just taking them in this endless pit of just over and over reliving an event that was so traumatic for them.
Yes, a lot of people do. This is the thing, I guess, where I come from. I wrote an article not that long ago, and I called it The Unconsciously Incompetent Parent. And it was aimed at mental health because when I'm running sessions with adults at workplaces, it's often they'll be so surprised, and people come up and talk to me afterwards and say, "Wow, I didn't know, how my brain worked. I didn't know how I think." And you're going, these people are parents, grandparents, and all that kind of stuff. And it's not that they don't want to know. It's the fact that they don't know what they don't know. So it's about saying that. So in a nutshell, they're unconsciously incompetent because they don't actually know what they know. And so part of what I'm trying to say is I'm trying to make you consciously incompetent, because when you realize you're not competent with something, you go, oh, I've got to do something else. I've got to find out more. And so that's kind of about, helping people become inquisitive about this stuff. The stuff I'm talking about here isn't new. There's lots of books on this stuff, but amazingly, when I do this stuff at that workplace, I'm going, who's reading all this stuff? Is it just people like me who are interested in it, or how do we bring this to the masses to really go, wow, I didn't know this stuff. I think it's a good idea to think about that, and how can I help my child? How can I, me knowing about these kinds of techniques helps me deal with my children and make them stronger. And when they do have a bad day, or something happens where someone calls them a silly name, or all this kind of stuff, the things that, influence young people, how do I help them deal with that? And being, I guess, armed and having some tools in your little tool chest there to help influence young people is a key part. And also how you react and what you say has a massive bearing on how those children respond, how those children interact and want to come and talk to you. So there's a number of things, a number of levels to this, not just about knowing a bit about your brain, but understanding how you, because we don't live in islands, right? We all interact with people on a regular basis, and sometimes things we say, as like little things like, saying to a boy, "Oh, suck it up, princess," big boys don't cry, and all these kinds of things, they have an effect on that child's psyche a little bit. And so if there's any fear factor to have conversations about how you're feeling, if you're feeling emotional as a boy, or I'm not saying it's just a boy, but I'm using that as an example. But, these are important things as parents that you need to understand about how you influence it. Some people go, oh, I was beaten by my parents and I come out all right. But yeah, did they really come out all right? Do they still have this anger and animosity, and do they deal well with issues? And so, when you really delve into some of those things, sometimes no, they don't. They're not all right. They use anger as their weapon. We often use fear when we're disciplining children, a lot of the time. And even our laws are based around fear. If you don't do the right thing, you go to prison. If you, speed, you get a fine. And so we use a lot of punishment and fear in a lot of the way we, I guess, mold people in society and even at home around, if you don't do this as a child, then you're not going to get any lunch money, or you're not going to get this. It's about withholding reward and punishment and adding fear to it. Is, people need to kind of understand that that's what we're actually doing. And a lot of times they don't think about that at
Sure,
that
we are
level.
definitely a fear-based society. And I like to tell people it's not so much the power is not in the stopping of a bad habit or if bad memories. It's not stopping, but starting. I believe the power is in the starting because a man can't turn from something until he turns to something. So if I turn to something and embrace that, I'm going in that dominant direction, which is so important. So you're definitely helping people to recondition themselves, their mindset. And if we would be able to do that as a society, that would be phenomenal.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's about people. A, it's awareness. B is, again, once you realize that you're not necessarily competent in that way, it's important about talking to people or reading things that allow you to at least add some strings to your bow, so you can be a bit more influential
Yes.
and that
So
kind of
how
thing.
have you been able to help people in what ways, I should say, who have been bullied? I know especially school kids, that has been happening throughout the years, but over the last probably decade or so, it's been, promoted, more awareness has been brought forth, especially in the United States.
Yeah, look, a big part of the program and the book has been written around the bullying side and how, and in, so there's two parts to it. One is obviously the individual that's involved in it, but then also how the group influenced that. For me, if you think of a bully, often the bullies had issues themselves. And so, when we think about that, how they've been, if a bully's, if a young child's been bullied at home or treated badly by the parents at home or all that kind of stuff, they feel a certain way. And again, this is where the patterns of feeling come in, right? So, ultimately, if you've experienced trauma as a child and you can't kind of, and it's caused by an adult kind of thing, you've got no real power to fight it or do anything. So what you're seeing from a bully generally is them taking it out on someone else, so to speak. And so part of, their anger and their rage is aimed at someone else. So there's some poor little kid who's, maybe not as physically strong, and this person thinks I can dominate them. They don't necessarily think that deliberately, but they feel like, I need some kind of cathartic effect. I mean, there's really good, studies on it where they did in monkeys where higher order monkeys who are under stress will take it out on the lower order monkeys, and then they feel better because their cortisol levels go down. And so there's a physical aspect to wanting to reduce your cortisol levels when you're stressed. And so, people smoke when they're stressed. People, so there's a number of these things that we do that kind of help with our cortisol levels and relax and all this stuff. And drinking alcohol does all this stuff temporarily, obviously. But ultimately, when we're talking about bullies, they're people who have got some problems themselves, and so they take it out on someone else. And what you see from that aspect is someone taking it out on someone else. So there's two parts to this. One, we want to try and prevent, obviously, the bully becoming the bully. And so for me, a big part of what I run with, my suggestions in my techniques for schools are about running sessions with kids. This is where the group comes into it. A lot of times when someone's being bullied, there's a heap of people watching. Now, some people might laugh at what's happening to someone else's misfortune. Some people are standing there thinking, oh, I'm glad it's not me, and all this kind of stuff. But effectively, not many people step in and go, you know what, Clint, that's not very cool behavior. You beating up on little Joey over there is not something that's good. And so, we don't realize how much influence the group can have on that. So part of, the things I talk about and in trying to help a school understand this is about giving the children opportunities to have conversations daily, early on, where, everybody has some time at the end of the day says, okay, what's been good about today? What's been not so good about? Has there been any things that have happened to people today that they're not happy about? And get people talking about it, because the more they, like what I see in adults, a lot of times they'll put up with some appalling behavior from people they work with, and they're adults, right? And so there's a fear factor of having those conversations because they've never done it, or they do it very badly. And this is where, again, red brain come in. Some people, they'll put up with it, put up with it, put up with it, and then suddenly one day they just snap. And then that rage comes out, and that anger comes out, and then they get in trouble. They bop this person or something like that, and they end up, getting fired over it or whatever. But, again, there's a lot of these things that happen that we can kind of do better at an earlier age. And helping these kids with these skills and having these conversations is so important, because one, it says to the bully, we're calibrating the behavior that's not good, so we're calling it out. The other thing is, when people go first, when I run these sessions with adults, it's really important for me to have someone in there that I know will actually talk about something if it's undiscussable. Sometimes with mental health, a lot of people don't want to talk about their own issues because there's a fear factor there. But if one person goes first, amazing how other people feel more courageous to then talk about those things. I mean, we see it all the time with like Harvey Weinstein and all his stuff, right? One woman came out, and then suddenly there were hundreds of women coming out. And why is that? Because there's been fear factor. These women, didn't want to come out for a number of reasons that involve them being scared of what could happen to them. So when people come out and are courageous, other people come out, they discuss things more. And so it opens up a better dialogue. And I just think, running those kinds of things says to the group, anyone can talk about anything. There's no undiscussable things here. It's saying to the bully, this is, bad behavior, and we're calibrating that we're not happy with it. And it also says to the rest of the group who might be thinking the same way that that's poor behavior. And if you do those kinds of things, we're going to talk about that. And so, it creates, I guess, a better culture. One of the things I certainly think about, when you come into workplace, they're all talking about, oh, we want to create a better culture. We talk about core values and all the usual stuff. Why aren't we doing that with the school children? Why aren't we, creating a culture that they're proud of, that they're involved in, and they understand that this is what we want. Again, focusing on a destination set, as I call it, where we want to end up. We want to have kids that can talk to each other. We are, and this is where diversity is so important too. Understanding that we can talk to people and not, oh, that person looks a bit different to me, so we won't talk to them. It's about including everybody, inclusiveness and all that kind of stuff as well. It makes things a lot better, and I think it again, it's more deliberate than what we probably
So,
do now.
the ways that I guess one way, if I'm hearing you correctly, is to prevent the bully from becoming the bully. Also, is
Yes.
the group calling things out and letting that person know that it's not acceptable behavior. Because I know when people have gotten bullied when I was a kid, there were always one or two people laughing and encouraging that behavior.
Correct. Correct. Yep, definitely. And look, I mean, I guess if you think of it like this, right? Like when, let's say there's a child who's a potential bully and they come into school and we're talking about their first days at school. They don't know anybody else. No one knows anybody else. So even though they might have an aggressive component to them or they're lashing out about or feeling upset about things, a part of having these process conversations is about also getting the encouraging them to talk about stuff. So if something's happening at home and they're going, oh, well, I've heard this other kid talk about something that's happening at home that's affecting them. And because we're not just talking about school, it's the same as work, right? Like when I look at people at the workplace, we employ the whole person. So what's happening at home is being brought into work, and what's happening at work will be brought back home. So it's important that we understand that, people don't just switch off and go, oh, I'm in work mode now. And okay, we probably have a work face kind of thing and things we don't talk about necessarily with everybody that we do at home. But, we are pretty much the same person. Things will affect us either way. And school's no different around getting people talking about anything. And if they feel psychological safety in those environments, people are more likely to come out and talk about anything. When I run suicide prevention things, people say, oh, can you tell us what to look for in a person that's suicidal? And look, there's some pretty obvious ones, but then there's also some things there where you go, there were no signs. And so part of, people can hide things pretty well. But the important part is for me, if we're going to do this really well, is about getting to a point where people feel comfortable to talk about anything. They know when they're suffering. So if I'm suffering and I'm thinking, uh-oh, I can't go talk to my father about this because the last time, I was emotional about something, dad told me to suck it up and be a big boy or whatever. So now I've got that fear factor about even talking about that with dad. Then that becomes a problem. And lots of people, I was talking to a guy not long ago about this exact same thing about, being a man and how friends will, look at you as a sissy or weak if you do this stuff. So if you see a friend who's been treated badly by the group because they say he's weak because he, showed emotion or whatever, then you're not likely to bring that up or do the same thing because you don't want that kind of negative feedback and stigma. And so same applies with conversation pieces. I think important to understand how us creating that psychological safety can change a lot of things for children as they become adults and as they grow up.
So, what are some signs that a parent should be aware of in their child that they may possibly be they're being bullied?
Look, I think there's two parts to this. So I think if you're a parent who do speak to your child a lot, and you've got a good relationship, it's important that if you notice anything's different, and it can be anything, they're just suddenly less talkative, or they're not interested in stuff that they usually are interested in, or even little things like, they're way more secretive, or they're just, oh, no, I don't want to talk about anything today. And they go to their room and they lock themselves in there and they're just withdrawing if that's not their normal way. The difficult ones are the ones that are naturally shy anyway. So you don't see changes of patterns because it's just what they're normally like. So, encouraging children, because there's nothing wrong with being shy, but the important thing, and this is where I work on the red brain, blue brain stuff, and when I'm saying to parents, at the workplace. If your child is super shy and they don't want to interact with people, there's a fear factor reason behind some of that. You need to kind of work out what that is and try and help break the pattern for them, because I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but we are social animals, and generally people who are that super, super, super shy, there's a fear component to it that's holding them from interacting with people. Our natural instinct is to normally interact with people, talk to people. And so encouraging some of those things is very important. But look, I think in general, if you're looking for specific signs, the normal signs, and it's probably not so much with children, but more with adults, is, not looking after themselves, not eating well, maybe drinking way more than they normally would, all that kind of stuff. With children, it's more around not interacting, not doing what they normally do. If they normally love watching soccer or whatever they watch, and now they're suddenly not interested in those things, that can be some little flags to at least have some conversations with them. And look, I certainly encourage parents that no matter what you're doing, no matter how you've maybe done it in the past with parents, it's important to say, have a conversation with the child about saying, look, no matter whatever happens in your life, I'm here to support you. And I might have said in the past, big boys don't cry and all that stuff, but at the end of the day, I'm still here to support you. I'm your father or your mother, and you can come and talk to me about anything. Creating that psychological safety for them to talk is a massive key, because if they can come to you, you don't have to look for the signs. They're coming to you and say, I'm struggling with
So
something.
when I
That's the
think
ideal.
of bullying, my mind immediately goes to children, but adults get bullied too. And what are some ways, some things that adults, how adults are bullied?
Yeah, look, sometimes again, it's, if we look at the classic Henry Ford way of thinking, and I do a lot of leadership work with people at the workplace, and we look at styles of management and all that stuff. The styles that are generally the bully are those highly, highly aggressive managers who just go, get in there, do what you're told. I don't want to hear anything different. And it's kind of, the classic kind of manufacturing mentality to get people to do what they want them to do. Sometimes it's not bullying in the classic sense that I'm targeting you specifically. They just, use a style that's highly aggressive. And so it can be seen as bullying, but they're literally just trying to get you to do more. And they're using fear to get what they desire. And obviously, when I'm working with managers, it's about saying you don't have to use fear to get people to work for you. There's actually better ways to do those things, and here are some of the techniques, and they're technique things. When you've got a classic bully who, is upset about something or wants to target some individual specifically, and look, it can be a number of reasons. Sometimes it can be a racial issue, it can be a religious issue. I don't like Muslims, or I don't like this, or I don't like that. And so, that they'll target that. And sometimes they can be very manipulative around that. They can turn people against people. Little things like ignoring people when they come into the room, or not acknowledging, those little things where you kind of, it's not right. It's hard to prove. Like the difficulty when it comes to bullying cases, and I've had to run these and investigate them myself, is when they're quite subtle. Little things like, oh, this person didn't get a shift, or that person, had a conversation with them. And sometimes the bullies are pretty smart. They'll only have one-on-ones, and so it becomes a he said, she said scenario where, in our laws here in Australia, we have to kind of build a case. It's not like criminal law. You have to, for industrial relations law, it's what they call balance of probability. So it's kind of 50-50. It has to be at least 51 to one side before we can kind of make a ruling on whether, something actually happened. So if you've got one person saying, this person bullied me, and then on the other side, you've got a person saying, oh, I didn't bully them, or I didn't say those things. It's really hard to have without, additional witnesses and stuff like that. So, look, it can be tough when it comes to bullying in the workplace, because, they're older, they're a little bit smarter, or you hope they are. And they've had practice with some of this stuff. Some of the worst bullies I've had, unfortunately, comes out later. And again, they use fear to hold it over people. People will leave organizations and then tell you about what happened to them over many, many years. Like I've had people, and again, this is where that right conversations need to be had. people feel comfortable to go, you know what? No, that's poor behavior. I'll have a chat with you first, but if it keeps going on, I'll take it higher and that kind of stuff. So, you know, from a workplace perspective, it's important that you're setting good practices in place. We have what they call a whistleblower legislation here in Australia where, you know, you can make anonymous complaints about people and it's built into to the policies and stuff like that. So, you know, I think we're getting better at using legislation, but the difficulty is again, still people still feel fear about having conversations, so they still won't. So, same kind of principles apply around developing that at the workplace. You know, when I was running sessions with teams, I really encouraged them about dealing with issues. If something happens, you got to have a discussion. You got to, you know, talk to the person. And part of that, you know, if there's people in the group that aren't going to kind of toe that line and really work within the team in a good way, then we maybe make some decisions and
I
move
don't
some of
know the
those people on.
numbers, statistics, but I would assume that people who, especially adults, people who are being bullied, they don't necessarily report it. It seems like it's easy to keep that person in shame because if you think about it, someone is more powerful than you are. You perceive them as being more powerful because they're able to bully you, you would be a little more shame. You'd be filled with shame and not even do anything and just kind of go away.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing to consider with this is bullies tend to pick on the people they know aren't going to fight back because what happens is that they test the waters sometimes. I'll give you a horrible example. This is a true story. I worked in an organization, I won't say where, but anyway, it was an organization where a particular person was a supervisor, and his kind of joke was if someone was bending over, it was to actually stick his finger in someone's bottom and laugh about it. Now, you know, clearly bad behavior. I didn't know about it until later. And anyway, but then as I did an investigation, so someone finally made a complaint about this guy. I was investigating it. So as I'm investigating it, all the people that work with this guy, he comes into contact with, you know, maybe 50 or 60 people all the time. And out of those people, he tried it with heaps of these people over years. And I'm talking not just happening in days, over years. And then I'm hearing stories of guys who didn't take that from him. And, you know, they'd say, mate, you do that again, you're going to be walking home with no fingers or something like that, right? And so some of them would be quite aggressive towards him and he wouldn't do it to them again. But the ones that didn't stand up for themselves, he'd constantly do. One poor guy, you know, for years and years and years would cop this. He was probably what you call a classic timid guy who, you know, he was an Asian guy, didn't speak a lot of English kind of thing. And so, you know, he just did not, he wasn't equipped to talk to this guy about it. He didn't feel comfortable talking to management about it. Even when I was doing the investigation, he was kind of really worried that, you know, because this guy was his supervisor too. So to your point, you know, when people don't feel safe, that they won't say stuff. Now, a lot of people might have left the organization because they didn't like his behavior, if they didn't feel comfortable. And this is what people do, right? They either tell the person, hey, you better stop that or you're going to have a problem. And those guys never get touched again. So he leaves them alone. The ones that hang around and don't say anything and maybe just giggle it off and hope it just disappears, you know, he's seeing he's getting away with that stuff. So constantly kept going back to that well. You know, really weird stuff, and it's a horrible example to use, but you know, it shows how many people see it happen. And then, you know, when I was doing the interviews too, even the ones that you know, were able to stand up for themselves, none of them went, they'd see it happen to this particular guy, and none of them felt, oh, I can go over and say, hey, leave him alone. I don't like it. He won't like it. So let's, you know, so again, encouraging those conversations at an earlier stage where you've got lots of kids that feel comfortable to step in and go, that's not cool. That is not cool. And again, using the group to have the discussion. If one person had said that in a group and he's done it to somebody, I reckon some other people might have jumped in and said the same thing and said, look, leave Dave alone. That's not cool. And we're not happy with it. So, you know, encouraging a lot of that stuff is such an important thing in organizations, in schools, because it happens all the time and it continues to happen. Like I say, with, you know, adults in their 40s and 50s, and helping them understand some of those things is
Yeah,
so
sounds
important
like
to
those
changing
same
things.
little kids, if they don't get the help they need to stop that negative behavior, they're 40, 50-year-olds that's, bullying grown adults as well. So, yeah. So, wow. So,
100%.
Clint, what is your one to grow on? What valuable piece of information would you like to leave our audience with?
Look, I think the important thing for me, if people are struggling, is to ask themselves if, if A, are they happy? Because asking questions of yourself is important because it changes those gears. And often, just finding out if you have a problem is such a key thing. I think self-reflection, self-assessment is a key because if no one wants to change their behavior and they don't, I've had people when I was doing counseling where someone else will bring, say, a person in and say, oh, this person needs counseling. Now, the person doesn't want to be there. They don't want to change anything or they don't think they have a problem. So nothing's going to change because they need to change it. There's not a counselor in the world that can change anybody unless that person wants some kind of change. So for me, it's about, being honest with yourself around assessing where you are in your own mental health space. Asking questions. And if you're not happy with it, then go and look at options. I think that's the key part is that once a person can get to a point where they go, you know what? I'm just not happy with where I'm at and I need to do something else. And then starting to think about what that something else is a great first start to any kind of change. One, it could be that they reach out to someone and have a chat. Two, it could be I go read something. There's even a really good assessment tools. There's one called Mind. I can't remember the name of it, but there's an actual website that allows you to go and check your mental health. It asks lots of questions and it does it like a normal assessment tool would, but you can do it anonymously and you can do it quick time online. You don't have to go see anybody, and it's about just asking questions, and then they basically assess and say, well, you might be at risk of this, and this, and then at least it gets them thinking about, well, how do I get out of this? Because if you don't want to be there, in that space, feeling bad and not enjoying life and rerunning things in your head, a key part is about wanting to make changes and understanding that the first phase is to do that assessment.
Thank you for listening to The New Mind Creator Podcast with your host, Maurice, The New Mind Creator. This podcast has been sponsored by Abundant Sports and True Serum. Head over to www.mauriceflournoy.com to receive more motivation and insight to help create your new mind.